Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and with me is our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hi.
And we are going to answer more of your cycling and triathlon questions today. You can submit them to us at trainerroad.com/podcast or use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad. Let's get right into it with Mark's question. Mark says, great podcast, and I've been devouring the episodes on my commutes to work and look forward to every new one. Speaking of commutes, during the last episode, and he references episode 69, so it's just a little behind here, you guys address bike commuting and whether it's really a beneficial workout. I've heard the cycling coaching world regularly rebuke the commutes training benefit and just wanted to address the one rider who wrote in. I think we all understand that it's far from a high-intensity workout, but he was throwing down 5 consecutive days, 10 hours a week, and over 120 miles of riding, of which many of your listenership could kill for. And you guys seemed, to me at least, to dismiss it as one step above sitting at a desk. And no, perhaps that came across wrong then, because certainly not. There has to be more benefit than just burning calories, which anything that keeps up that strength to weight is beneficial, he mentions. Is there any minimum commute, hour, mileage, or TSS threshold that is coach approved, and he says that in quotes, where it is considered training to be a faster cyclist? Any tips for making your commute more beneficial?
Yeah, Mark, I think the context in which we discussed that was relative to the prescribed workout and how it wasn't exactly on par with it and how difficult it would be to simulate interval workouts during a commute. In no way did I mean to imply that commutes aren't worthwhile training time miles. There's no minimum. There's no particular mileage or TSS that makes that coach approved. The fact is any riding is potentially beneficial. Really, it only gets to a point where it's not beneficial is if you're in an overtrained state, and that's not what we're talking about here. So any miles he can log are of some benefit. I didn't mean to imply otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I think our stance is too, is that if commuting is taken away from your interval training, mm-hmm. then it's a problem.
Exactly.
If you
right.
can do your 2 to 3 interval training sessions a week, and I think some people can actually handle 4 with special genetics, probably not many, but mm-hmm. 3 is probably the limit, Chad, don't you think, for most people?
Yeah, I think 2 to 3 is safely it.
And then you can do what we call TSS fillers, where you are then riding the rest of the time. And as long as they're not...
commutes would qualify.
Exactly.
Quite well.
So that could be a steady approach. Just don't make it where you can't do your workout because
exactly
I rode
right.
this morning too hard on my commute. Or even if it was... It can even be the point, depending on how experienced you are and how your genetics are, is that even easy rides for commuting, 120 miles, could take away from your interval workouts.
And the one thing that you can look at is if you are pushed to the limit with work capacity with your interval workouts and you add commuting into that, that could be cutting away from time that your body would be using to actively recover or do anything else. So
yep.
makes it tough. So the one thing that I've noticed when people first get into commuting and if they're already training is that it has a profound effect on their training and they didn't anticipate it. It's pretty common. We think that just noodling along or commuting to work it wouldn't add any additional stress, but then it does end up affecting our workouts. With time, perhaps you can get used to that and you can understand the kind of a new baseline and recalibrate things a bit.
That's like his kind of point is an extra 120 miles a week.
Yeah.
Just on anyone. If you're always doing
that's
200
a
miles a week or 100 miles a week and you go to an extra 120, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
That's
yeah.
A lot of riding.
Absolutely. So yeah, we're all about making things as focused and effective as possible. And if the commuting detracts from that, bad. If the commuting somehow helps that, great. So that's our stance on it. Cody, he says, how does swimming impact rest and recovery? As a novice long-distance triathlete, I have some difficulty in scheduling swim sessions around my Trainer Road bike and running sessions. Due to my work schedule, I have to adjust the Trainer Road triathlon plans. 3 early morning swim sessions, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, work best for my schedule, but Monday and or Friday would usually be my rest days after a hard Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, as well as a Saturday, Sunday training. Would I be better off having a true off day, or is swimming low enough impact that it won't negatively impact my bike and run training? As a novice swimmer, I want to be sure that I get all the time in the pool I can, but I don't want to hurt preparation for the important disciplines.
Let me start.
Yeah.
Cody, that's largely for you to determine. I mean, obviously, it's going to depend on the intensity of your swims, but swimming does have the capability to be at a low metabolic cost in that it's not having any negative impact on the recovery process, assuming you don't push it too hard.
I've never had a swim session that was low metabolic cost. Like,
well,
for me, swimming drains me.
I remember so much. Last time you were training for a half Ironman, and you would come back after your swims, and it looked like somebody had just, like, on Princess Bride, pushed you to the brink of death. Like, somebody had just ran you through that machine.
I've just taken 2 years of your life.
But yeah. My girlfriend, Amaret, she's a longtime swimmer, and she can swim fluidly and easily. She can keep the metabolic cost low.
Didn't she swim in college?
She did. Yeah, so the fact is,
that's a big difference.
It depends. And I hate using the term, it depends. Sounds like a lazy answer, but it truly does depend. How good a swimmer are you? How efficient are you? How low intensity can you keep
it? Cody's a brand new swimmer. Mm. He's a novice swimmer. He did not swim in, but I agree. If you're a D1 swimmer and you swam 8 hours a day in college and you come back and you swim an hour, three times a week, it's probably not that big of a cost.
As a beginner swimmer, I'm going to guess this is probably going to be a little too taxing to qualify as recovery.
You put me in a pool and I'm like the most panicked, exhausted thing in the world after 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It's about not drowning. It's not exactly swimming.
Exactly. Right. That's where I'm at too. So in Cody's situation, what would we suggest? If let's assume that those swim workouts are indeed taxing on him.
It's a tough one because being the fact that you're a novice swimmer means you need a lot of focus on your swimming. So if you can figure out a way to weave those in, that'd be optimal. Doesn't sound like that's really an option here. So I would still take an off day. Give yourself one single off day where you're not doing anything and you're just letting your body heal would be the first recommendation. Beyond that, trying to weave in those swims, I know swimming is kind of time intensive too. You got to get to the pool, you got to change, you got to shower afterwards. It's not a quick, go downstairs, hop on the treadmill, hop on the trainer sort of endeavor. So I feel for you, but I do think you need one full day off.
Chad, you've always been a big proponent of a true day off.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And any time I fly in the face of that, and I do it often enough to remind myself that it's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
I have like a, this is a side note, but I've been fantasizing about a dream house one day. And part of that, this is a triathlete's dream, is that maybe I'll get back in triathlon if I can do this, is I want a room that's big with open, like slide open Hawaii style walls that kind of slide open so you can open it up. And I want one of those swim spas in the floor. It's like 10 by 14. I've never used one. I need to try one, but they have like a jet going so you can swim in place. Wow. And then I put an iPad below me
in
the pool.
Why not a plasma screen TV?
Yeah, you're
something larger than an
iPad.
Think
big.
Because I don't think I'm going to, these swim spas are fiberglass. The iPad, I can put it on a waterproof case. I can put it below and wear waterproof headphones.
Mm. So you can't go waterless
in the water.
Put the thing in the water.
Yes.
In the water.
And then what you can do then, I can either breathe on both sides or they have the little like front snorkel. So I get all the oxygen I can while I swim, which I think isn't a bad idea. I know a lot of college athletes do that. They'll do intervals like that so they get maximum aerobic intake while they're swimming. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then they also don't have form issues like a triathlete does. So there's times for both of it. But then I could swim in the morning.
Sighting's not a real big concern for a collegiate swimmer.
Yeah. And exactly. And watch the show down there. Have a treadmill in there. Have my bike. Have it all set up in kind of a room. Have it all tiled so I can kind of hose it off. And have it open up in the summer and close in the winter. Doesn't that sound awesome?
Chad and I are dreaming bigger. Ours has a glass bottom and we have the whole thing as a screen.
I've got a lap pool. I need to move when it comes to swimming. The idea of a treadmill while swimming just...
No, man. Okay, so think about this though. It's the difference between a lap pool, you stare at a black line, or you get to watch Mr. Robot or... There's like so many cool shows.
I could see myself coming around to that way of thinking and the elimination of kick turns and the fact that you're swimming steadily. Yeah, I could make a strong argument for that myself.
You can come to my house, my
your fantasy house.
Yeah, my fantasy. You can come into my brain. Oh, Chad, you're there right now. You just told me you loved it.
Yeah, I picture myself just being a fly smashed against the back of that pool from the current. So that would be me. Cody, good luck and patience, man. It's tough.
The other thing I want to tell Cody before we move on is if you're not comfortable with your swimming, drop like a run workout or a bike workout so you don't have problems in the water because you don't want to have problems in the water and add that extra swim.
The anxiety alone would probably not be worth it.
That's a great point. Let's go into Alan's question. He says, hi, I'm transitioning between sweet spot base 1 high volume and sweet spot base 2 high volume. And for those that don't know, those are our base training plans. They have two consecutive halves. So you move 6 weeks into one and then 6 weeks into the second version there, or not version, second half of it, because it is very unique. and I'm concerned that the length of my longest ride has reverted back to the lower level, and it doesn't appear to build on the length of my longest ride conducted in phase one. So he's talking about those weekend rides, probably dropping in duration. He says, mm-hmm. I'm training for a multi-stage event, 3 days of approximately 100 miles each day, and I feel I should continue to maintain and increase the length of my ride, 3 hours plus at this stage. Is this sensible or unnecessary wasted effort? Many thanks for your time. Very much appreciated.
Now, and the reason those rides came down in duration would be a TSS concern. I don't want to ramp the training load too quickly. And that's where things kind of balanced out. So other workouts over the course of the week up the TSS. So I had to sacrifice it elsewhere to keep that TSS from ramping up too quickly. Doesn't mean that if you can tolerate it, you can't ramp the TSS up higher, especially in base period, exceeding, you know, recommended ramp rates or progressing things a little more quickly than you'd otherwise do in the build and the specialties phases is far more acceptable in base. So if you need that longer ride, feel free to modify, make it what you need it to be.
Hmm. So this is kind of similar to a situation that I'll be, at least I plan to do in January, which is ride from San Francisco down to Santa Barbara. So that'll be like 3 days.
In when? January?
The coast
January.
Ride?
January, yeah. So I don't know if I'm going to do the coast ride. And apologies to anybody that really likes that ride, but it's a big group of
wet
folks, and I'm not sure I really just, it's not that I'm antisocial. I mean, clearly, you know, but I just want to, I don't want to be surrounded by that many people. So I'd like to do something like that and have a very small group of people or even just myself on something like that. So, but I'm looking at about 3 days of 125 miles roughly a day is what I'm looking at on something like that. To give you an idea, Alan, for that, forgive me, I'm not planning to emulate the duration that I would experience 3 days in a row prior to that. And it's not because I'm not planning to peak for that event or anything else like that. I just know that if I make sure that I have my power where I need it to be, then it's going to be, I'll be able to work out the distance later on or that duration. That's one thing that I've learned is that you don't have to emulate. If you're going to do a 5 hour ride, you don't have to do, or a 5 hour race, you don't have to do 5 hour rides to prepare for it. You can prepare very well with 2 to 3 or even 1 hour rides coming into that. So perhaps not necessary to spend that. And it's arguable even that you could be spending that extra time that you may be riding on those Saturdays, spending time recovering or spending time refining that strategy of what you're going to do in between those days of training. Maybe you're testing something out with cooking, who knows what else, but maybe you could be recovering more too. So recovering makes you faster too.
And then Alan, my little tidbit of advice in terms of stage racing, or in this case, it's not a race, but it's a multi-stage event, is just nourish properly. Just each day you're basically nourishing your body for the next day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're trying to shed some weight or do these in a semi-starved state, might not be the best day to test out that sort of approach. I know we condone that a lot, but it has its proper timing.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Chad said, if you get behind the eight ball on one day, it's going to affect you really heavily the next day. So
this kind of sounds like fun.
Yeah. Hmm? Yeah.
We should probably experience something, one of these sometime.
I'd be okay with that. An endurance podcast camp like that, a little 3 to 5 day jobber.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to come with me?
Hmm. Well, I'd like to do it part of the big ride, not just.
He just doesn't want to
do the coast ride.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
Well, yeah, just, I think we should do some of these longer multi-stage Gran Fondo things. But I think it would be good for our experience, just like Cross has been good, and people might find it interesting.
Share all the details with y'all.
Yeah, yeah. I know that a friend of mine's planning LA to Tijuana back to LA. Oh.
No, thank you.
I think there's going to be debauchery halfway through. So yeah. But anyways, hopefully that gives you some insight there, Alan. And we'll let you guys know if we plan out anything on a long ride like
my
that.
My neck hurts already. Could be cool. I need to go.
You need to go get that worked out.
Yeah. So this is a little side note, but my number one limiter on the longer stuff, even in the TT position, is I get this nerve, like tendon thing. I'm not sure what it is, on the right side of my neck. And even just on my road bike, anything longer than like an hour, it starts to hurt. And it just hurts so bad. And it feels like my entire neck is held up by this one little muscle nerve.
Yeah, no, and that's actually an argument in favor of doing your longer rides to make sure things like that don't crop up over those longer durations.
Yeah, well, mine come up, and even the more it doesn't go away with riding more. I think talking with Jonathan and some people, I think it's just something I need to go get it worked on. And Jonathan has a physical therapist that slash masseuse, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Is he a chiropractor too?
Probably. He's an actual medical licensed professional, so he is a doctor. So
I can move my neck to the one side, like right now, and my neck like spasms. Like there's a thing that happens. And
I'm gonna say it because other people are thinking it.
I need to fix that before any of these.
Massage therapy.
Yeah. I'm gonna say it because other people are thinking it. It's not coming from me, Nate, but HTFU. So we've got.
Well, I'm still going through
it. That's a long time to endure that sort of discomfort. I had something similar.
It just makes the fun less.
My massage therapist did a particular hold. It was literally a 5 minute where she'd pull my head away from my body sort of thing. It was boring. It seemed like it wasn't doing anything.
Taller.
Honestly, it's more than anything ever has helped.
Yeah.
Who's that?
So,
okay, we'll talk about that afterwards.
Katie Olson.
Yep. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Kevin's question. He says, 5 stars from Canada. If they're Canadian, 5 stars, perhaps they weigh even more. That's good stuff. Got into cycling a couple of years ago when I was overseas in the Netherlands for a year. I'm currently 52 years young, avid user of Trainer Road, and it has helped me improve my FTP while at the same time drop my weight from 193 pounds to 160 pounds today.
Bam!
Nice work.
That's awesome.
Yeah, 5 more pounds to go. I'm upgrading my group set and wondering if it's better to go with a subcompact set versus a compact with an 1130 cassette. We have a lot of decent hills where I live. For training, do you gain more turning a tougher gear ratio versus an easier with a full compact set? Yes, it would be easier with a compact, but in the long run, should I train with a subcompact knowing that it is improving my muscular endurance more? And that's his assumption there. Thanks for Trainer Road, as I am truly addicted to cycling and training to improve.
Kevin, I am and forever will be an advocate of the quicker you can spin, the better, to a point, of course. But the idea of lessening the muscular burden is in terms of energy conservation and just sheer enjoyment is enough for me to support that view and always will be. So depending on the types of the hills, I would base your choice on that, such that I'm a big fan of riding above 90 RPM just in general. And that applies to climbing in a lot of cases. Mm. So if you can keep your spin more aerobic, you know, don't tax those sugar burning fibers any more than they absolutely have to be, and keep it, you know, more fat burning and therefore more easy to sustain over longer durations, then that's absolutely the way to go.
I think too, if you're racing, Kevin, like, I mean, how fast do you really want to go when you're training? It doesn't sound like you're a racer, but if you're going out for enjoyment, do you really want to get up to like pedaling at 40 something with a, we just did this on my Venge on a subcompact. So I was trying to make the decision between a standard and compact, and Jonathan turned me on to a subcompact, and that's actually what we went with.
Which falls in between, correct?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a 52-36, so 52 big ring, 36 little. And for those that don't know, standard is 53-39. Subcompact is the next step down, 52-36. Compact is the next step down, 50-34.
And then what did I go in the back? I think 1128, right?
1128.
Yep. So we did the little math. You can go online and
Sheldon Brown's gear calculator. That's what you should Google. And you can, he has different cassettes already laid out. So you just select what cassette you're going to put on. You tell him what diameter wheels you have. And then there's a cool setting where you can basically say at X RPM, how fast would I be going? Which is actually a really valuable one, because if you look at, you know, at 80 RPM, or 75 RPM, which is usually like where people will be really slowing down on the climbing side of things, like 70 RPM in that range, you can see how fast you'd be going with that gearing versus also on the top end of things too. It's helpful.
I think I forget the exact speed, but it was way well into the 40s at like 100 RPM.
At 120 RPM, I think you were at like 46 or something.
Yeah, but I'm not going to go 120 RPM spinning, but it was enough that like at that speed, I'm probably tucking. And I'm not going to be sprinting at 42 miles per hour.
Yep.
That would be scary. And then also what we thought of is if I did need more gears in the back, what I would do is go to a 32. So I'd have to get a different rear derailleur.
Or Wolf Tooth. Well, this company called Wolf Tooth, they make a little adapter that basically drops your derailleur about an inch. And on that Everesting ride, Dylan Nord, one of the guys that we were with, he bought that. And we were all kind of sketched out to see if it would work or not. And I think he put in like a around the block test, which is always good before a 222 mile ride, but it worked great. And he was able to run a 36 with just a little bolt on adapter that basically where your derailleur usually mounts up, you just mounted this piece in there and your derailleur mounts lower. Nice. So, and he could run
like a $20 part sort of thing.
Yeah. It's pretty cheap. I can't remember the exact price, but yeah, Wolf Tooth Components. That's the way
actually, I think I look the up. SRAM mid-range rear derailleur, does that go up to 32?
Mid-cage goes up to 36.
36. And I think I bought a mid-cage.
Yeah.
So I'll be fine.
You should be
fine. I could just change cassettes.
Yeah, I think, and I could be wrong on that, but I think a mid-cage goes all the way to 36.
Yeah.
And then a long cage is needed to go to their 1042 cassette or like a Shimano 1146 cassette.
Mm-hmm. And then Kevin, back on that, you ask if it's, if you gain more turning a tougher gear. I'm still not a proponent of slow force work for building strength. I think strength gains come in different manners. The endurance ones do. And even if you're turning a big gear, say you're doing 50 RPMs, that's like bench pressing 50 times in a minute. You're not building strength. That's simply not how it works. It's not to say that that slow force work isn't without merit. You can reinforce the muscular tendinous joints, improve your tendon to muscle connections. And you can also, if you're using it to try to discern where in your pedal stroke you might have a weakness or an overly tight muscle or something where your knee strays from its, you know, what should be its straight up and down course, it can be useful in that sense, although dangerous in that you're going slow and exerting higher force on a joint that's not very stable. Mm. But as far as building strength, it's really kind of a traditionalist old wives sort of approach.
Mm. And we talked a little bit about this on the last episode about the benefits of riding at a lower cadence aren't as much to build strength, but they're to prepare you for the varying cadences that you may come across on race day or whenever it counts. So you should be fine with what you've got there, and don't worry about pushing heavy gears. So Matthias. Anybody else want to throw out a version?
It's Matthias.
Okay. I like Matthias.
Matthias. Yeah. Hi, I have a question about baking soda. Is it something to take before hard, intense workouts? Have any of you tried it? Great podcast, and keep up the good work.
This is, I think, the trend of people talking about like alkaline and acidic and how your body is. Yeah. And there's like even alkaline pH water.
Two words, kidneys and lungs. They manage your base acid balance better than anything you're going to ingest. There is some science on this. There's a long thread. If you haven't ever looked into it, there's a Google group called Wattage. It used to be a topic of forum. In any case, it's now Google Wattage group. And there's a big, long thread on this. Rick Stern from, I think he's UK, contributed his sodium citrate study. And they're all the same thing. Basically, you're looking for lactate buffering. So, you work harder, more lactate in the system, more acidic accumulation, more muscle burn, et cetera. People are trying to find ways to dodge some of that, just try to tone down the accumulation so that they can work harder, work longer, whatever.
This is common in our record attempts.
Yeah,
there's
not anything that really supports it. I mean, the closest would be that Rick Stern, his sodium citrate, where he did it over, I think, was it even sodium citrate? No, it was sodium phosphate, and he did it over a 3 to 6 day loading cycle, so it was a bit more elaborate. But in any case, whether or not this stuff sticks, whether or not it has a measurable effect, a favorable one, and whether or not you can get past the diarrhea and the stomach upset that often comes with these loading methods is super problematic.
Yeah, with the stuff that bothers me on this kind of thing is it's always explained, and it sounds like, oh yeah, that would work, because it's like A equals B, B equals C, C equals D, therefore A equals D. Go do it. And what I want to see, and there might be some haters in here, send us some studies that are like, these athletes did, you know, these tests, it's like direct comparing performance.
Yep.
They did it without it. They did it with it. We measured that some pH was different.
Yeah.
And it was, they didn't know if they were taking it or not. Right. So they were going to eliminate placebo.
Yeah.
I want all of that kind of stuff. I hate the A equals B, B equals C equals Z, therefore A equals D. And sometimes they go A equals Z,
and
right?
It's just like supplementation. You have to consider how it comes into the body and how your body is used to processing it. And this is very different. You're ingesting it as opposed to, it, you know, its internal bicarbonate buffering system. Two different things. You can't just, you know,
and
make
it
work
take
as
a
you
lot.
Want it to.
It doesn't take a lot to experience those side effects at all.
A couple tablespoons of, in your case, you're talking about sodium bicarbonate or baking soda, can lead to severe diarrhea.
And extreme discomfort. And it's funny, this is probably a useless question to ponder here, but the hour record attempts, before the modern attempts were done, if you read anything about the hour record, it made it seem like people were turning themselves inside out and collapsing. And I think it was, well, I can't remember who, but one of the guys that he did it, he said he had to be carried off the bike and he couldn't physically move for like 3 days afterward, right? Like, it was, the hour record was super storied. And I wonder if some of these guys, because they claim to have all taken sodium bicarbonate.
A lot of dope, too. What year is this?
Right? Yeah, exactly. I wonder if it was just because these guys took on so much sodium bicarbonate or that they were feeling terrible. So who knows? I heard something that Wiggins may have taken this before the hour record.
But might have worn pink socks.
Exactly
too.
Right. And that's the point, right? Is that it just because he did that does not mean that it contributed to his performance that day in a positive way. So it's tough. Are there any studies on this other than that one that you mentioned, Chad?
There were a handful of them out there. Yeah. None of them made me want to go try any of this. None of them appeared. There were weak correlations. One of them was better at short power. One of them was better at 30 KTT. Hmm. So there's some information out there.
Interesting. Okay. Cool. So if anybody has studies, send them in. One exactly that follows the parameters that Nate laid out.
Follow exactly, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Larry's question. He says, thanks for a great product. I've been using it for 2 years, and thanks for the podcast. I find the podcast to be motivational, which is good this time of year. My question is about training for Xterra Triathlon. Since Xterra has a mountain bike instead of the traditional time trial, and he says mountain bike leg is what he means there, instead of the traditional road time trial, I believe training would be a little different. The terrain will cause power spikes instead of steady power. So he, first of all, before we get into his training plan suggestion there, Chad, what do you say about that?
Yeah, it is different. I think in this case, a couple things to say on this. First off, I would recommend crossbreeding the tri plans with the mountain bike plans. Just plucking those mountain bike workouts out, plunking them right in where they would be in the triathlon plan, because exactly as you pointed out, this is not a steady state endeavor. This is more of a surgy, more anaerobic contribution sort of work. So you do the tri plan, follow it strictly, you're going to go into it a bit underprepared or unprepared in certain ways. So, to that end, I have now been given the keys to the kingdom, as it were, and I have a training plan admin tool, which is going to allow me to crank out a lot more plans. Not that we need a ton more, but it's going to make my job quite a bit easier.
You can get more specific.
More specific, yes, exactly,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and one of the plans I absolutely plan to do is an Xterra tri plan. Mm. So whether or not it'll get the full treatment where I do a whole base build and specialty, or if I just insert a specialty plan, I haven't quite decided yet. But the fact is, this is one plan that's very high on that list.
We should be talking to a local guy, Matt Balzer, about this, because he's a multi-time Xterra champ, even at the world's level there in Maui. So the demands, though, I want to talk about the demands on the running side as well. And on the swimming side, they aren't any different, right, Nate? I mean, it's you're swimming
open
in
water swim.
It's open water swim. Mm-hmm. So that's the same. But the bike, as you just mentioned, Chad, very different. There's a lot of skill component, and triathletes, by the way, I'm not bagging on you guys with this, but you're notorious for having a lack of bike skill. And the Xterra side of things, that's not the case. You need that bike skill, or else you won't be getting anywhere.
I'd like to do an Xterra. I wonder how gnarly the course is. Is it just like a cross-country course, or is it?
It depends. Some of them, I've talked to Matt and some other people.
And he's
some
a great mountain biker.
He's a
great
very mountain good biker. Mountain biker. He's as good as me on a mountain bike, and he's infinitely better at swimming and infinitely better at running.
Yeah.
So, but he's mentioned that some of them are really tricky. But I think that they're tricky because of the elements. They're certainly challenging physically in the sense that, it'll require a lot of your aerobic or anaerobic performance. But technically speaking, I don't think that they're going to be as technical as an outright average XC course, at least in our area. So yeah, they might be more in line with you there. But so it'll definitely be different on the bike. You'll need a lot of skill components. But what about trail running versus normal running? Is that different? Should people alter things there?
I don't think it's enough different to have to modify the run workouts as they stand.
You're not coasting downhill and resting when you're running that. You're kind of just running the whole time.
Yeah, the efforts are going to be more evenly paced.
Yeah.
I assume that things are more, you have to be okay with more variance.
Even in the tri plans, I have a fair amount of hill repeats and stuff that's already kind of along those lines.
The biggest thing I'd say for trail running is learning how to run downhill. We've talked about before, leaning into it, not like stopping yourself as you're running it.
The opposing option would be like kind of like leaning back and.
Yeah, you kind of get these really heavy foot strikes as you're going down. You see a lot of people do that. If you kind of lean into it, you can go really fast and you got to get your cadence up.
Yeah, it's a lot of self braking, but it's also a lot of eccentric muscle load, which is potentially really damaging if you're not conditioned for it.
Yeah, and that's a great way to get injured. And there's another race, TBF race in Folsom, and it's a triathlon, but the run is trail. And there's one section where I was racing against a friend, and he would always beat me there. It was so steep and technical that he could run down it, but I couldn't. But that's very few and far between, and I wouldn't really like practice that part because it's like 10 seconds, but right. It's enough where he'd pull ahead for 10 seconds and he beat me by 10 seconds. But I mean, you usually don't get something that technical. At least I've never done Xterra, at least in regular right. trail running.
I know athletes like Liz Lyles, for example, she triathletes, even at that elite level where she is, she spends a good amount of time running on trails too, even though on race day, she's going to be running on the road. But in some cases like Wildflower, which RIP Wildflower, sad day, but that race had you running on dirt and trails for a decent section.
And a huge downhill at the end.
Yeah.
It's like this really steep, steep downhill and at the very end of the run. And it's, I want to say 8% or something.
Wow.
Yeah. For a good point. And I'm not sure the exact percentages, but that's what it felt like.
I wish that race would come back. That would be cool. So hopefully that gives you some insight and something to look forward to as well, Larry, in the near future. Matt, he says, I have some friends that want me to ride the Load of Jaw Double Century Fall next year. Have you guys ever heard of that race?
Yeah. Okay. I got lost saying it.
We've got a lot of people that prep for it locally here because it's in Utah. It's not that far away, well, relatively speaking from us. He says, I've not ridden very much in the past number of years, probably less than 20 hours this year and only about 40 the year before. And I'm wondering if this is doable. I tested my FTP to be 207. I'm 185 pounds, 6'2", and in my early 30s. If it is doable, how would I go about training, especially if I would like to finish in 14 hours? The elevation gain is around 7,500 feet, which, by the way, is kind of astounding that you can accumulate so little elevation over such a long duration in the Mountain West.
207 miles, 206.
Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah, so it's they really work hard to make that thing flat there. And he says, it has that elevation gain, so I'm not sure if focusing on century type training or climbing is the best either. Thank you.
So Matt, it just so happens I coached an athlete for 5 years, and over the course of that, he did Load of Jaw every year, and he's since done it and probably did it maybe once or twice before that. He's in his 60s. It's Rob. He might be in his
Rob
70s
Kopenauer.
By now.
Great guy.
Anyhow, he is about 6'0", weighs about 185 pounds. He's much older than you are, and he has a threshold in the low 200s. So I was reading this question, and I was like, wow, that's Rob. So I called up Rob, and he basically told me the times he's finished it, and he's ducked out a few times, but he's finished it 4 times out of, I think, 8 that he's done it. Mm-hmm. He's done it between 12 and 13 hours at that threshold, and training roughly 5 to 8 hours a week, and I'm doing basically what the sweet spot base plan and the sustained power build and probably the century plan equate to.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, there's your trainer road track, but what I'm trying to get across here is that you don't need to invest as much time as you think you do. Do the proper conditioning and the rest will actually take care of itself.
And Matt, though, so you haven't been doing a lot of training. You're 40 and it's next fall.
Low 30s, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, 40. Yeah, but this year and about 40 the year before. Oh no, that's many. He's in the low 30s.
Low 30s.
I'm sorry, Matt. Even better.
Yeah.
So low 30s. You have 10 almost months to train.
You're golden.
You're gonna
knock it out.
You're gonna knock it out, right? Yeah. Like if you can totally get your FTP a lot higher. You can lose some weight if you just stay consistent in training, even just with low volume stuff.
Something that Rob did add though is that there are different ways to ride Load of Jaw, and that you do it in a group where you're sharing work with others, which mm-hmm. Obviously is going to be beneficial.
Which is especially key toward the end, I hear, because the wind picks up.
It's flat and windy, and that can be your day basically. So if you're out there alone by that point, it can be a very different experience than if you're out there with another couple of riders, or best with a group of riders. So it's not just about having the conditioning going into it. It's also how you ride Load of Jaw.
Yeah. And so I took the liberty in this case to run your information through Best Bike Split, by the way. Matt, hope that's okay.
And this assumes a solo effort.
This also assumes an ideal scenario, which I've found was actually, I've constantly been surprised with Best Bike Split. It's pretty darn close to what ends up happening in reality. So with your FTP, with your weight, everything else like that, it says that if you rode and you had an average speed of 14.67 miles an hour, so roughly 15 miles an hour, that you should finish just under 14 hours. So that gives you an idea of what you need to carry in terms of pace. Now, in terms of power, it would be around 115 watts. That's easy to do. That shouldn't be too bad.
Yeah, with the 207 watt threshold, I mean, that puts you at what?
It's 0.55 60% IF. So that's low. That's something that's very much doable.
I wouldn't be surprised though if you're at 250 by the time the race comes.
Oh, that's
the
other thing. Your fitness is going to
go way up.
Yeah, you're looking at shooting for sub 11, maybe. You never know. So sub 12, I should say. So yeah, that'll be cool.
It's absolutely doable though, Matt.
Yeah, I don't envy you. That's a race that it's a beautiful area, but I'd rather drive that if I need climbing to make it exciting. So, but good on you for going for it, Matt. Let's go into Josh's question. He says, "Hey, Trainer Road, I realize that the specialty plans conclude with a taper that's designed to leave you as fit and fresh as possible for your A race. And A race, for those that don't know, you have your A race. That's the main goal you're prepping for. You have B races that are not quite as important, and you'll do them leading up to that A race. And then C races are the ones that you'll do regularly, but you don't put any type of, you don't care about winning or losing
those
ones.
Workout.
No real taper involved with those.
Yep. So he says that our workouts or our training plans conclude, our specialty plans specifically, the ones that you have at the end of your season of training, have a taper built into them. When scheduling out a full 28-week base build and specialty program, how many days prior to that A race should you schedule the last workout in the specialty plan for? For example, if my A race is on a Saturday, should I schedule my last workout of the specialty plan for the day before the race, 2 days before the race, 1 week? Do you want to cover that one?
Josh, I try to write these into the week descriptions to sort of help you along with this process. But and I also, at the 4 week mark, at the end of your, I think it is the fourth week or the third week. No, it's at the fourth week, at the end of the fourth week. So you've recovered, and then I try to schedule a practice race. So maybe you can line up a C priority or a B priority event, or simply simulate one. But the idea being that you gain a sense of, you know, how long do I need? A lot of people need to do a short, hard workout the day before the race. Some people do it 2 days before and then recover the day before the race. It's a pretty subjective affair. So you have to determine, are you, group A or group B, which works better for you. So give it a shot. But in any case, a short, hard workout, where you schedule it all depends on, you know, what works best for you.
Yeah. Like Chad said, it's going to vary. I know that I deal with, or I do really well if I have leading up to it, even the day before, if I have a workout that, or 2 days before, usually I have a pretty tough in terms of intensity workout, but it's low on volume. And I found that really works for me.
Super low. Yeah. And that's an important point to register is you don't need to do a lot of work. If you look at the taper workouts, look at it in any of the plans, the taper workouts fall in the 7th and 8th weeks of the specialty plans. They're super short, but the intensity is right in line with everything you've been doing the preceding couple of weeks.
Hmm. What about for you, Nate? Have you found anything that works specifically on tapers?
I haven't found a magic one. What I'm doing is just following exactly what the plan says. And then on that Saturday, let's see, we have a Saturday Sunday race for district championship. So I'm doing, I'm signed up for one race on Saturday and two races on Sunday. And so it's at the same park, our race, but it's a different course. But it's a lot of it overlays kind of the same stuff. So I should feel more comfortable in that area. But I was thinking, Chad, I could do the 4.5s, which is a 30-minute race, and later on do the 45 on Saturday. But I think I might do just one race on Saturday. Then on Sunday, 4.5 in the morning, which is a 30-minute race, and then do the 3.45 after that.
Yeah. So, in that case, I'm not big on doing a race prior to a race on the same day. If that second race is important,
the first race is important.
Okay. So
4.5, because that's the four, I'm not going to win the 3.45, but I'd like to be competitive in the 4.5. And
So what I'm trying to get across is that any race prep should be done the day or 2 days prior, not day of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have, if the 3.45 was going to be my one, I wouldn't do the 4.5.
Okay. Understood.
Let's go into Luke's question. He says, "I love Trainer Road and have been using it from the beginning, but next year I'm doing the Boston Marathon. I'd like the period from January to April to be a focus on marathon training," which, by the way, congrats to getting into Boston, whether that's through lottery or qualification. It's
qualification.
It's all qualification. Mm-hmm. Sweet. That's really awesome. Good job, Luke. He says, "Originally I was thinking I'd just try to maintain the sweet spot base plans through until the race and next spring. Would those be the best approach in order to keep a decent base for cycling and triathlon season next spring and summer, which will ramp up after the Boston Marathon? Thanks for your help."
I'm probably going to come at odds with certain running coaches, but I've always been an advocate of incorporating a little bit of cycling into run training simply because there's a positive carryover and it's less detrimental to your joints. It depends on how seasoned of a runner you are. A lot of runners need high volume and the bike training simply detracts from their run performance, as opposed to some runners who perhaps have a lot of room to grow and they can use the fitness from the bike and carries into their running quite well. I'm not sure where you fall on that spectrum, but if you're simply looking to maintain your bike fitness, I've said it a number of times, maintenance doesn't take as much as you might think. So the aerobic component of it is going to be covered just fine with all the running you're doing. So you might just do some muscle endurance work. I mean, something that even a couple short VO2 max workouts, but you don't need to do much. I'm not sure I would devote more than a day a week to riding your bike if you're really focused on doing well in Boston.
So maybe
two.
Maybe the Tuesday workouts in Sweet Spot Base?
Yeah, and whether you want it to fall early in the week or later in the week is going to depend on how you structure your running load. Last thing you want to do is fatigue yourself going into a big running week. So I'm not entirely sure.
Right?
Yeah, it is very
if
much so.
If priorities like... he just wants to finish it and feel good rather than go as fast as he can. Maybe he's two times
ride
a week.
Ride a couple times a week. In fact, you can keep on doing a low volume plan if you want to, if that's the case.
Yeah,
but if you're
true.
Looking to do well there, the more you can run, the better, you know, assuming you can avoid injury the entire time.
But if Luke's going to run 50, 60, 70 miles a week, maybe drop cycling and all together.
It'd be hard to put those together. It depends. It's for you to determine if you can handle that sort of load. I just can't see that being advantageous or beneficial for too many athletes.
My wife, so she's going to run a marathon this weekend, and she, in case anyone wonders, we're recording two podcasts back-to-back, because I think last time I mentioned that too, but she did a whole bunch of cycling training, and then a whole bunch of long rides, and it worked pretty well for her.
I've had terrific carryover with it. The mistake I make commonly is that I carry such high-level cycling fitness into it that I end up running too much too fast and injuring myself. So absolutely be aware of that if in the case your cycling fitness is high relative to your running fitness.
That's common with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bummer.
Yeah.
It happens all too often.
Let's go into Daniel's question. He says, first off, 6 stars for the product.
Yes, Daniel.
6 stars. I don't know how he broke the rules there, but thank you for doing it. I caught up on all the episodes during a 14 and a half hour drive one way. Holy cow. It made the drive enjoyable and got me stoked to ride. So thank you. My question is, for cleaning drivetrains, what type of product and what procedure do you recommend? I have the Park Tool chain scrubber and I'm out of their fluid. I don't want to buy more since it's pricey. It's for a road bike. Thank you in advance.
This is a Jonathan question.
Yeah, so I don't like those chain scrubbers. And
I don't like them either.
Have you guys ever used them? I've never had good luck with them.
I've used them, but they just like link and they don't
same
keep
here.
Clean.
They're messy. They're frustrating. They just don't work that well.
No, and what I've found is they're really good at just kind of brushing things along to a different point in the chain. Like it doesn't seem like it actually really catches anything. So... now, I personally, what I do is I use, and first of all, the biggest key to having a clean drivetrain is clean your drivetrain every time. And all it takes is 30 seconds to clean your drivetrain. But if you neglect that and you let it go on for 5 rides or more, then it's going to take you 5-10 minutes to clean that drivetrain. But if you just do it a little bit every time, it's really easy to clean. I use, and this seems kind of ghetto perhaps, but I use a rag and I use soapy water and I use a chain lube. It's Dumont Detex Light Lube. It's like in a yellowish bottle. It's like a yellow fluid. And I use that stuff. It's not the fastest. We've talked about that before, but it's really good at with variable conditions. If it's dry and dusty or if it's wet and muddy, it doesn't get affected and it comes off really easily with just soap and water. Which is nice. Some of them, you get that on there and it's hard to get the lube off and then it ends up gunking up your drivetrain forever. So first step, keep it clean all the time. Number two, use a lube that doesn't stick on and gunk up everything. And then I just use a wet rag and soap. I grab the chain and I usually start at the master link to remember where I started, if it's not obvious because your chain's getting clean. And I just grab that chain as hard as I can with a rag in my hand and I scrub, and then I just roll my chain forward slightly and I do it again until I've reached the master link again. And then after that, I wash it out with a hose.
And then prior to big races, Daniel, I actually removed the chain. You have that quick link. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, KMC makes those ones you can remove.
Makes it quite simple. So you take it off. I keep an old water bottle around, and I simply stuff the chain in there and flood it with Simple Green. And then I just let it sit. Every once in a while, if I'm down in the basement, I might pick it up and jiggle a little bit. But it sits there for better part of a day. Pull it out. It is perfectly clean.
Yep.
And then, you know, clean the rest of the drivetrain, put it back on. And my lube of choice is Squirt.
And so reading, you're not supposed to use like Simple Green on bike stuff.
I've read
I
that.
Do. And oh, it works great.
Yeah. Bike mechanics that know what they're doing, they use Simple Green. So
I don't.
Yeah. I suppose you could dilute it if you're really concerned.
If you see, if you look, so this year at the Tour of California, right? When they are up here in Tahoe, we toured around with our photographer, Michael, all around the pits. And we were talking to a bunch of the guys. Every single team mechanic bus had Simple Green, and that's what they were using on their stuff.
I would argue their stuff, though, does not need to last for 2 years, is that they're going to get, they're doing it, they have stuff for the tour, and then after the tour, that stuff's gone, and they're getting brand new stuff. So
the one thing that Simple Green can affect is anodized coatings that aren't high quality. If they're lower quality, what it can, like if it's red, for example, sometimes what it can do is it can actually wipe a lot of that anodized out of there. So you'll have like,
what do you mean
strikes.
Red? SRAM red or red
so
in color?
So let's say you have like a red anodized aluminum part. So okay. Red in color, it'll actually reduce the intensity of that, make it so that can happen.
We have that jewelry cleaner that we bought, and we got the denatured alcohol to clean a chain. Mm-hmm. And I haven't taken my chain off yet because I hope you can help me with this. I have the 11 speed on my cross bike.
Yeah.
But I don't have, we got the quick release ones, but that's only for 10 speed. Yeah. What can I do? Can I take it off?
I haven't seen a single person that makes them for 11. Hey, everybody. Coach Jonathan here, just cutting in really quick. We've got a lot of emails about this topic that we're talking about right now, about the quick link for 11-speed chains. And I messed up. Nate and I both misunderstood each other, and we thought that we were talking about the chain link, but really we were saying chain. So you don't have to throw away the chain, but you do need to throw away the link unless you are using a Whipperman Connex 11-speed link, a SRAM, KMC, and Shimano. Even if you are using those links and reusing them, you are not supposed to reuse them. And they say that that's because there's not enough material on 11-speed links to make them reusable or durable enough to be reused. However, Whipperman says it's all good with their link. Hopefully that solves this issue for you. Back to the podcast.
Yeah. Well, even if it's not a quick one, can I just buy an extra, like I can take off the link and put
a
new one?
So these links, if you look at a link that has like flared ends on it, very small, but they're flared ends. And if you press that through a chain, those flared ends get flattened out. And then your chain has a weak point in it. And I've broken countless chains because I was an idiot and thought that you could do that. Because for example, for a motorcycle, you can just press it back in. You can break a link and then press it back in and you're just fine with a chain breaker and a press. But on a bicycle, you can't. They have little flanged edges. And if you do that, you have a serious weak point in your chain and it will snap eventually. So you have to have a master link or a quick link, as they call them in the bicycling world. So you need that quick link, and nobody makes an 11 speed one yet that you can just undo and then put back on.
So how do I take my 11 speed chain off?
You have to break the chain, and if you have to take the chain off completely off your bike, mm-hmm. and you break that, you have to get a new chain. That's the
a new chain completely.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I can't. So Chad, how do you do it?
Yeah. Don't you have 11? I'm not entirely sure. I've done it with an 11 speed chain. Come to think of it,
you've got all 10 speed on this stuff that you've been doing. So
yeah.
So it's. I think that they haven't been making the replaceable links either because there's a great conspiracy here and they want to sell more chains, or number two, because perhaps they've found those links to be less reliable. Nobody wants a liability issue. I've never had a reliability issue with a 10 speed removable quick link.
I was so pumped to take my chain off and get it like super clean for.
Yeah, I just took that for granted. I assume there was an 11 speed quick link.
Yeah, I couldn't find one. That doesn't mean that there won't be one soon. So KMC,
let us know.
Yeah,
if you're listening, or if anybody else knows of one, let us know. It shows that it's like a 10 speed, 8, 9, and 10 speed only thing, and mm-hmm. they don't have an 11. So that's the way to do that. If your chain is super bad, like really gunked up, I would recommend the Simple Green approach, trying to put it in a bottle. If it's a 10 speed one, you can do that. If not, then what you can do is also take a rag, and you have to be really careful if you have paint or a carbon fiber frame, but use something like acetone and a rag and put that below your frame, your chain stay, and grip that chain and then scrub the chain with your hand in a rag that's soaked in that. But you don't want to get that on your tires because that'll make them dry out. You don't want to get that on carbon stuff, and you don't want to get it on paint.
The other thing is reading friction facts. I can never say that.
It's a tough one.
Is that you should have no tension on your chain, because when there is tension, that will keep stuff like the dirt between your links. That's where the friction comes from.
Totally.
You want to have no friction. And that's why I kind of like the idea of the jewelry cleaner, is that it will help, like it vibrates and it gets the, it loosens the stuff inside of that.
Which when you get a new chain, you should still, if you have a jewelry cleaner and everything else like we have, you should still do that, because those chains come packed with like really heavy sticky grease. And it's really hard to get that stuff out. It takes a long time. So that's a good way to do it. So that's what we'd recommend on chain cleaning. Those little chain brush deals, not sure they're really worth it. So Daniel says, oh, forgive me, no, Joe is next. He says, I'm new to Trainer Road and can't wait to see how much I can improve my fitness and cross racing results. I gave the podcast 4 stars.
What?
Hold on, Joe. Why'd you
next
give us
question.
4?
Next question. Pete.
Joe. You can go back and give us 5. You probably meant to give us 5, but you accidentally gave us 4.
Exclamation point. I'm thinking he meant 5.
Yeah. He says, I used to donate blood about 3 times a year, but have stopped completely as my commitment to training and racing has grown. How much of an impact does donating blood have on training? I would imagine it varies a lot with what phase of training you are in. And I could also say from person to person there, can I ever donate without causing a serious setback in my training? What if I make that week a recovery week? Appreciate your thoughts on the matter. Thanks and keep up the excellent work.
We have no idea.
You know,
I know it tires you out. And
I have anecdotes.
Good.
That's it. Whenever I give blood, and I've done when you give plasma, so like they really take out like a lot of blood and replace things, give blood period, I'm wrecked and my energy levels are completely dropped. And last time I did it, it took me almost 2 weeks to feel like normal again.
Yeah, I don't know how long it takes for the body to regenerate that lost volume.
Yeah.
So I can promise you that it doesn't have a positive effect on training.
It does not. No. And timing it with a recovery week, I don't think is beneficial.
Yeah, I don't know about that either, because you're looking to basically recover, heal, and now you're going to take a liter out of your body or however much they take out.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, so we'll look into this maybe some more, but I know from myself, anecdotally speaking, it's not that it doesn't...
I bet there hasn't been like studies on this. It's like,
no.
I don't want to sway you from donating blood, but I can't recommend.
You know, my wife, on the other hand, because every time we've given blood, we've given blood together, and she's like, she feels great. So I'm sure it affects different people differently. And
she HTFUs more than you.
Oh, did it. Bam.
That was good.
We'll just dangle this line out there. If anybody can contribute on this matter, please don't hesitate.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to know more about it. So Pete, he says, as we move into winter here in the UK, how important is fan cooling when I am on the turbo trainer?
Very.
I train in a shed in the garden. In the summer, I know I need a fan or two to keep me cool, but when the ambient temperature drops, how important is it?
Very.
I did Table Rock tonight. The ambient temperature was a few degrees below zero, and that's 0 Celsius, I assume. He's from the UK. I needed gloves to keep my hands warm. I was getting a cramp in one foot because of the cold, or he assumes because of the cold, but I was sweating a fair bit. I had my fans on a low setting, and I was still pretty cold on my bare skin. Do I need to worry at all about fan-assisted cooling when the temperature is below zero? Or should I keep the fans going on a low setting and try to keep my core temperature down? Keep up the good work. Love the training program and the podcast.
You do need to worry. It is. So this is a common misconception. It's evaporative cooling. That's where you get most of your cooling from, not just from the temperature. And I've done the same thing that you've done and experienced the same thing, where your hands and feet are freezing, but your upper body is sweating.
Yeah.
You do need, if you're sweating, that means your temperature has gone up high enough that your body's trying to cool itself. So you do need a fan, and your fan will do more work as that your sweat will be a little bit, you know, you're evaporating in that cold environment and you'll be a little bit cooler. But yes, totally have the fan.
I'm going to take a different approach. Ooh. And not exactly disagree, but say that it's more contingent upon the level of effort. If you're not working that hard and you don't need the cooling and it's not affecting your performance, there are actually advantages to working through that temperature. Not that those are what you're after, but the fact is you can still get the job done.
Temperature?
the temperature increase. So just, you know, your body's trying to offload heat, you're sweating, doesn't necessarily mean you need to cool beyond the point that you're already at.
Yeah, but I mean, he's not going to get to the point either where it's so hot in the room where those studies
were he's talking about table rock, which I think is 3 by 85 or 3 by 15 at 85%. Mm-hmm. So it's a sweet spot. It's a low end of sweet spot. So you don't generate a ton of heat. I've done workouts like that without a fan because the room was cool. If, however, I decided I needed a fan because it was making the workout more difficult than it needed to be or more difficult than I wanted it to be, I just put on a base layer, and it helps quite a lot in terms of at least keeping my chest from being frigid.
I agree with that, but I just don't want people going away with like, the room is cold, therefore I don't need a fan.
Right, because it's not just the room temperature.
Agreed.
Because if you're sweating and you have a layer of hot sweat on your body because it's being heated up from that, and you don't have a fan cooling you off externally, it's just stagnant air. Yeah. You're not getting that benefit of the cool room as you would normally. So kind of creates like a layer of hotness.
That evaporative cooling is still very important. But I'm simply saying if the intensity is light enough, table rock might actually be a little higher than that. And you're not sweating profusely, or you feel it's not limiting your performance, then ditch the fan.
Evaporative cooling is amazing. Here's a little side note here. But when you are cooking a brisket and you get a full, Nate's really big... Which,
if you guys didn't know, Nate is huge this is into performance barbecue. Related. Yeah.
No, but what happens is the temperature goes up pretty quickly until around 160, 165, and then you hit what's called the stall. And your brisket will stay at that temperature for many hours in a row. And that's because what's happening is some of the moisture is getting pushed off and it's actually sweating out and evaporative cooling. So your meat's not getting any...
Interesting.
The temperature's not rising because of that, even though it's in an oven. It's this evaporative cooling happening on the meat.
So how does this carry over to Pete on the bike?
What?
How does this carry over to Pete on the bike?
The amazing amount of evaporative cooling is that you can be in a oven or barbecue.
I got you.
And have evaporative cooling.
It self-regulates almost within.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing.
And you wouldn't think that it was that much. Even in this hot environment, it's doing it. But the way people get around it is they just cover it in tinfoil. That has nothing to do with Pete.
Well, so Pete, in that case,
cover yourself in tinfoil, Pete.
And that, really wanting a really hot piece.
I can relate. In that I just turn my fan on the lowest setting rather than the highest setting. Mm. And I steer it down. My fan angles up toward my face. I steer it down more toward my legs. Mm. So small changes like that. Maybe you can strike a balance between still having a little bit of air circulation moving around without getting too cold.
And personal pro tip here, Pete, when I'm working out and it's cold in the garage, I'll start with my fan off until I'm getting warmer. And then I'll just slowly turn that fan up a little more.
I do that every time.
So, and that's
I start high volume for the beginning.
My basement is pretty cold though.
So. Yeah. Yeah, so I'll do that, and then I'll slowly pick it up as I feel my body getting warmer and needing to cool off. So,
side note, if you want to see Chad's basement, go on our Facebook page.
Oh, there is awesome
Chad's
video.
Basement there. Yep.
Awesome video. I got a lot of Snapchats about that where people thought it was awesome. So,
cool.
Pretty cool stuff. Well, that's it for this week's questions from this special bonus episode that you're getting this week. Pretty exciting stuff.
Bam, you even got barbecue. Lucky
I know.
You.
Good stuff. You can submit more questions to us at trainerroad.com/podcast or use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad. You can find us on Snapchat at TrainerRoad and send us more questions there. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll chat soon.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.